Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, sir.
Today is the 6th of May, 2008, and I'm now with Mr. Kabiru Ibrahim, the UN UNPOL Elections Advisor, with UNOSIL, the UN mission in Sierra Leone, and we're now in Freetown at the UNOSIL headquarters. Well, thank you for your time. And before we start, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent to the interview.
Thank you. You are welcome. I have already signed and given it to you. I have given my consent. Okay. I'm being interviewed, and I'm doing it voluntarily.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start the interview by learning a little bit more about your personal background. The jobs you held before this position, and particularly, how did you get involved into policing work and policing work overseas?
Well, that's a very long history, but if I might shorten it, I was in the military because I went to Nigeria Military School, Zaria. From there, you know, I felt that the job satisfaction I needed, I was not getting it in the military. You know, the military sent me to the university, and at the end of my career, I decided to change and join the police, and have been a police officer for almost 22 years now. And the second part of the question, my involvement in the international police started as far back as 2000, March 2000 to be exact, when I was deployed as a UN police officer to Kosovo. I was there from March 2000 to 2001. I was there for a year. You know, after that, I was also deployed to Burundi in June 2005, no, 2004. I was there up till December 2005. Then I've been here in Sierra Leone from February 2007 till now, and hopefully I might be here up till September 2008.
Okay, thank you. Can you describe for us your position in each mission, and your particularly within the mandate of your mission, what was your particular roles?
Yes, in my first mission in Kosovo, I worked as a patrol officer. You know, I also work in the special operation. You know, and I was equally involved in training the KPS, the Kosovo police officers.
In a particular specialty, or?
General policing. And in Burundi, you know, I was the chief of staff there. So there, I work more or less as an administrator, administering the with a very little contact with the Burundian police, perhaps due to the language barrier, because my French is not so good. And here in Sierra Leone, I have been working primarily as election security advisor for the elections, the presidential election, which we did last year, and now for the local government election, which is coming up in about 2-3 months' time. You know, I have also worked here as a crime advisor to the Sierra Leonean police. But that I have relinquished to another officer who is looking now.
Advising on what, sorry?
Crime.
Crime advisor. On the CID?
Yes. Okay. Or crime management.
So, when you first arrived, can you give us like your first impression, your first assessment of the status of crime and public order in Sierra Leone, and maybe some of the major challenges that the Sierra Leone police was facing in that domain in particular?
Oh, when I first came here to Sierra Leone. When I first came here in February, you know, I found the country generally to be a relatively stable, or I say very stable, because the crime rate, maybe in comparison to where I was coming from, Nigeria, it was very, very low. You know, occasionally we do have an upsurge, you know, where you record within 2 days, 2, 3, 4 armed robberies. But generally, I want to say it has been very stable, you know, very stable.
And what were some of the areas that you focused on when you worked as an advisor on crime management?
Yes, the area I was particularly focusing on is in the investigation and prosecution of cases. I was quick to discover that an average investigator, once he makes an arrest, the investigations are not thorough. It's like they are always in a hurry to charge these cases to court. And once these cases are charged to court, you know, he think he has completed his assignment. So many cases, you know, when it comes to discussions, case has been charged to court. No follow-up to know what is going on in the court. In fact, once the case goes to the court, it's more or less left to the prosecutor to do what he likes. So, cases, the police are not after convictions. And I always tell them that, look, the essence of any investigation is to make sure after the arrest, you conduct a very thorough investigation, charge the case to court, follow it to the logical conclusion, and see that at the end of the day, you know, you are able to present your case in an organized and orderly manner that you could achieve convictions. you may want to know, during my stay there, I did voluntarily on my own, just by trying to encourage them that whichever team has the highest convictions, whichever IPO, investigating police officer, has the highest convictions, I was willing to give them some mobile phones, you know, so that the police will know that, you know, it's not just charging the case, but you must ensure that you investigate very well and you are able to convict. You know, during our days as IPO, the ambition is to say, look, it's not just the number of cases I have charged court, but the number of convictions I have been able to achieve. You know, we used to be proud to say that. But here, unfortunately, it's not the case.
To give a rough idea, how many of the cases actually lead to convictions, and how much of this is related to how well the case was prepared by the police? And have you seen some improvements also?
I must be frank with you. Up till the time I was there for about like 3 months, I did not see much improvement in the convictions. No. It's like nobody was able to, no one person was brought to say, oh, this person has been able to, you know? So it's like they're always in a hurry to charge these cases to court. And once, apart from cases where maybe the suspect plead guilty, you know, and he's sentenced by the magistrates, but for cases, you know, to be convicted based on the investigation, based on evidence provided by the police, up till the time I left, I cannot boast of any from them.
Now, before we enter some technical areas of police reform, I was wondering if you could maybe describe for us what a typical day for you. So now you work primarily focused on preparing in the elections and advising on election securitization. And can you describe for us what your regular day of work would you look like, and what your function is?
Generally, as the election security advisor, we have our men outside in the regions together with the SLP counterparts, threat assessments of all politically related offenses are being monitored. Threat registers are being compiled and updated, you know, and it is this threat register, which we classify them into three major headings: the high threats, the medium threats, and the low threats. So as the election comes nearer, our deployment of security is going to be strictly dependent on our threat assessment. Those areas we have high threats, we're going to deploy, you know, a lot of manpower there, so that in the event of any disturbance, it they'll be able to move and take care of the. So, also considering the level of the state finances, you know, the UNDP is financing most of this deployments and the operations. So we have to get the number of men that will be deployed for UNDP to pay the money out of the basket fund to provide ration for the police officers, also to provide money for the training of the police officers to be able to perform, you know, effectively during any operation, and also to, you know, compile the number of vehicles they have, because UNDP also have to repair these vehicles and provide fuel for their operations. So this we do on a daily basis. Training, continuous training, threat assessment, compiling names, you know, these are the
Last question before we get into functional areas is how much pre-deployment training did you receive, and did you receive any induction training when you first arrived in the mission or in the past mission with the UN as well, and or did you get like a handover briefing from your predecessor and so on?
Yes. For induction training, in all the missions I visited, Kosovo, Burundi, we received adequate induction training. But what I want to say here is that is like the level of induction training. Compared to what I mean, let me put it this way. In Kosovo, we were given induction training for, I think, 5 days or 1 week, if I can remember. And sorry,
excuse me,
tissue. Yeah. And in Burundi, I think the induction training was for about 2 days, and here I think it was a day. So it's like the level of induction training, you know, the intensity which in the past, you know, is reducing. Though I may want to observe here also, you know, maybe the intensity of the induction training is based on the delicate nature of the mission. You know, Kosovo was much more volatile than my two previous missions. So maybe that is what explained. But there was an induction training. What's the other part of the question?
And the handover from predecessors.
Yes, as for handover, there was none. Well, there was none in Kosovo when they also knew mission was just starting. So, and the mission was was an armed mission, and it was being administered by the. It was new. The same thing with Burundi. In fact, we set up the Burundi mission. So there was no handover. We had to start, you know, everything from here. But here, again, there was no handover. And the reason probably was because when I came here, I was assigned a different function that nobody was doing it before. So I want to believe maybe that is why there was no handover. But I knew before I left Burundi, I handed over to the person who was occupying my office based on the best practice. In fact, then the best practice office was introduced and we had documents which we used to hand over.
So now the first technical area I'd like to talk about is training and professionalization. You mentioned you've been involved in training with the KPS, the Kosovo Police Force in Kosovo,
yeah.
And here as well, some mentoring as well. Can you describe maybe some of the training programs and particularly like the techniques used and the how you develop curriculum and so on? Taking specific examples maybe of that.
You see the training I was involved in Kosovo was more or less a direct training because the KPS is assigned to you. You understand? You do virtually, it's practical. You do virtually everything together.
On the job.
On the job. Mm-hmm. So that once there's any case, you go together, you respond together, and you want to see, you know, the action he's taking. And you use your past experience and tell him that, oh, you should do it this way or that way, you know? On a daily basis, that was, you know, some part of the job we're doing. So it's not like a classroom where you have to prepare your lesson plan based on the... like I told you, in Burundi, you know, my apart from the induction training, which I was directly in charge of for the new officers coming, you know, both military and the UN police, I was not directly training the Burundian police because of the French. Factor. Here again, I have not been, we have a training cell who are the ones conducting the training, but you know, we direct them. The training here has been more or less on crowd control, investigations, you know, and prosecution of cases. Then, of course, indoor training, which is being organized by the security section, which from time to time they ask us to go and give them lectures.
In terms of the crowd control, so some UNPOL officers here are assigned to the task?
Yes, we have a training department, and we have about 3 officers there, you know. It is within their schedule to organize and you know, provide training for the Sierra Leonean police. You know, we have 4 officers. We have the traffic and the crowd control. You know, considering the volatile nature of the country, the way and manners, you know, some spontaneous cases come up. we met and felt that each division should have a PSU, CCU, MAV, almost on a ready position that could be able to respond to any challenges.
From your experience in training, have there been some particular ways of training that have been successful? And I'm thinking in terms of training, especially when led by an international, is quite expensive. Or do you have suggestions on cost saving way of doing training?
Yeah, I think especially for a country like here, which is relatively poor, you know, the best training method would be to select some few Sierra Leonean police officers, train them as trainers, you know, and assist them with some logistics to be able to train other officers. That's, I think, is about one of the few methods that could assist in reducing costs, training trainers so that those trainers can train others.
Currently, in terms of both crowd control and the training for election security, are you training trainers or training larger groups of police?
Yes, yes. I know that for the general crowd control training, a lot of officers, Sierra Leonean police, have been trained. Also, in the traffic, a lot of officers have been trained. And the investigation and prosecution of cases, a lot of training has been conducted. So I think in terms of training, the Sierra Leonean police have benefited a lot, not only from the UN, but also from other NGOs, from other countries. They have been trained. So, but the problem they always encounter is that these training departments are never adequately funded for the trainers to either organize the training themselves here in Freetown or move into the different regions to be able to train. Always the problem is logistics. So if the UN can face squarely the training department of this Sierra Leonean police, provide adequate support and logistics for them, I'm sure they have enough trained manpower to be able to train other officers.
Mm-hmm. When looking at the broader reform process, and we understand your current role is focusing on the elections and the past election and the coming election, but if you look at the broader reform process, what are some of the broader challenges that the SLP, the Sierra Leone Police, is facing? And in your opinion, what should be the priorities?
You see, the reforms basically, I would say three major issues. One is finances. You discover that they know what to do, the police officer. They have been trained. But because of the poor welfare packages, poor logistics at the station level, and almost in every aspect of the policy, the response to the public is always very slow. I mean, if you go to the nearest police station, which I think you should go, and say you are there to make a complaint, you see in most of the stations, the manpower are not there. Where they are there, the manpower are there. There is no vehicle to take the complainant or suspects, you know, for further investigations. Or where there is vehicle, the vehicle may not have fuel. You understand? Even where there is fuel, you know, at the station level, they may tell you they don't have paper. You know, so you as a complainant, you are kind of asked to provide paper, to pay money for paper, to provide fuel for a vehicle, or you have to take a taxi. So you see, the finances and the welfare packages of the police is affecting all the reforms. Right now, some recruitment have been conducted since April. Training is supposed to have started, but nothing is being heard about it. And the reason is that there's no money to provide for the trainees, for the training to start. So you see how the finances are affecting almost every aspect of the reform. Secondly, the command and control of the Sierra Leonean police. Is virtually not there. I mean, the bedrock of any police force or any uniform force is discipline. You discover that here, the officers does not appear to have control over them. Every person appears to be on his own, doing his own. So some of us really wonder if the UN leaves, what is going to happen. And the third aspect of the challenges facing the SLP is the dichotomy, the division between the armed OSD section and the Sierra Leonean police general duty. There is either distrust or lack of understanding or lack of communication between the OSD and the general duty. The OSD, they daily feel marginalized by the senior cadre of the SLP. So this dichotomy has to be solved. You know, I will want to suggest that until a day when there is free mobility for the officers to move into any of the two sections, either general duty or OSD, after some time and vice versa, until that is done, there is a big challenge there.
Is that the third point? You have a third?
Yes, it's the third point. You know.
Are there any innovations or experiments that have been tried in Sierra Leone you think merit attention, that we could learn? Any innovations or experiments in Sierra Leone that you've observed in the Sierra Leone police that you think merit attention or interesting, that we could learn from? Innovations. As part of the reform.
Yes. See, the family support unit section of the is very, very vibrant. Given adequate finances, adequate logistics, I think it is worth emulating anywhere.
One last question, if you allow me. One last question. On the now on the UN side, regarding your experience with three different UN missions. Are there any two or three suggestions that you would make on changes in either UN management or policy that would help you do your job better?
Please, can you repeat that question?
Are there any? Do you have any suggestions to the UN based on your experience in the different in three different missions that would, for you, would help you do your job easier, better?
Here.
Or from your experience in Kosovo or in Burundi, thing that you were thinking that if this could be changed, if this could be different, it would be better for me, for the UN.
For the UN? Yes. I don't know. This could be rather difficult for the UN system and procedure. But I would love to see the UN police section. In a position, strong financial position, to recommend and be allowed to carry out reforms and changes without passing through the bureaucracy of the UNDP. You know, as we work with all this police, you could see certain things that are really needed by the police, which doing them will bring the police, the whole of them, to you, because they know you are there to help them, to assist them. Reforms, changes that are not much in terms of money, but you make these proposals, you have to go to the UNDP, and it's at the mercy of whoever is there. If he says no, then it is no. You have no finances to do anything. I mean, I will give you an example. When I was in the crime management, they listened to us. I mean, they are eager to learn. They see you as somebody who is coming to assist them. But you see some basic things that are needed. They ask you that. Maybe you see the shortcoming. You say, but why not like this? You say, oh, this thing is not there. This thing is not there. This is not there. And you know, these things are essential for any good policy. You said, okay, don't worry, I will come back and discuss with my bosses, and I'm sure we'll get these things done. Then you come back, you discuss, and it's taking forward because you are not financially capable to do it. And then somebody rejects it, oh, we cannot do this. You may even at times have to lobby to get certain things done. That shouldn't be. So I do hope someday the OMPUL will be financially strong, because having a budget of their own that they can write and recommend, you know, so that they can help the police they are working, because they see exactly what is happening, not being subjected to going to all the time to donors, or see if they like they do, if they like they don't. So I think that will help the UN a lot, and will remove these accusations which the UN are just here to spend money, drive big cars. When you ask them to do small things, they cannot.
Okay, any final comment?
Well, okay. We are gradually succeeding, and I'm sure with more resources, we shall make the difference.
Mr. Kabiru Ibrahim, thank you very much.
You are welcome.